All right. I know we do have a number of people still being dialed in, and others we can see calling in and logging on. We're going to go ahead and get started to keep on time and begin a brief presentation of the actual results of the voice study so that we can keep as much time as possible for questions. So some people will be joining undoubtedly and only hearing part of this, but want to really respect all of you who did join, and particularly Jeannie Marazzo and perhaps others on the west coast of the United States who are up quite early this morning to join us. My name is Mitchell Warren. I direct AVAC, and I'm really delighted that so many of you could join today's call. It's a really important call, as any of our prevention trial results have been over many years. The voice trial results are critically important to understand where we are currently with prevention and with research, as well as to help chart some new ways ahead. Right now, as many of you know, the call is in a global mute to keep the line clear. Jeannie Marazzo, the principal investigator of the VOICE study, along with Mike Cherenje from Zimbabwe, is going to present the results very briefly. We will then take questions, and as you'll see at the very end, you can do that by either unmuting yourself by hitting *7 to ask your question and then *6 to mute yourself again. During Jeannie's presentation and throughout the call, you can enter questions on the chat function if you are logged in on the web, or you can email at any point to avac@avac.org, and we'll keep those questions in the queue and ask those of Jeannie and others who are on the line as we go. We are recording the call, and we'll make this available on the web afterwards, and also we will undoubtedly have questions that don't get answered on this call, so we will certainly be working with Jeannie and others on the VOICE team to answer those questions and posting those as well. So that is the plan. For those of you who are able to log in to the ReadyTalk system online, you can follow along in the slides. If you are having any trouble but are able to get on the web, the slides are actually loaded already on avac@avac.org on the homepage, and you'll be able to see, I think the very first link is actually a link to the PDF of the slides. So hopefully that will be clear to one and all, and we will get started. So without further ado, let me introduce Jeannie Marazzo from the University of Washington in Seattle and the co-principal investigator of the VOICE study, who has led a remarkable team in a number of countries to prepare this trial, implement the trial, and presented these results just a week ago today at the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. But we did think it was helpful for Jeannie to go through the results on this call to then set the stage for the conversation. So with that, Jeannie, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Mitchell, and good morning and good afternoon to those of you farther east, I guess. Really grateful for the chance to discuss the VOICE results with you, and I just have about 10 slides. I think it will be pretty quick. I'd rather spend the time hearing your questions and thoughts. So if we could advance to the second slide online, that would be great, and I'll go ahead and get started. So I think, as many of you know, the VOICE study was a phase 2B randomized double-blind placebo-controlled five-arm trial, and I'll show you what that looks like in the next slide. The key thing is that we randomized or randomly assigned participants to three products that we hoped would prevent HIV acquisition in women. And women were instructed to use these products daily, and that was a distinguishing feature of VOICE, very different than the Caprisa 004 study, but very similar to the previous studies of oral PrEP, namely IPREX, Partners in Prevention, and TDF2. So those three products are shown here and I think are pretty familiar to most of you. There was a vaginal tenofovir gel, and that's a picture of the applicator. And then there were two tablets, oral tenofovir and then oral Truvada. And if I could have the next slide, I'll show you what this study design looks like. So don't be too freaked out by this kind of busy slide. Just gives you a sense of the flow of what happened here. We ended up enrolling 5,029 women who had a negative HIV antibody test when they enrolled. Some key features that were required of these women in order to be enrolled included that they had to report being recently sexually active with a male partner, so vaginal sex, in the prior 3 months. They could not be pregnant, they could not be breastfeeding, and that was due to concerns about inadequate safety data for these products during pregnancy and breastfeeding. And like all of the other PrEP trials, or most of them anyway, they needed to be willing to use effective contraception during the study for the same reason. And that included hormonal contraception of oral or injection delivery systems. Once they were enrolled, they were asked, as I mentioned, to use one of the study products each day. They could have been on the arm that included the oral tenofovir, the oral Truvada, an oral placebo pill, or the vaginal tenofovir gel, or a vaginal placebo pill. And recall, for those of you who don't remember, the placebo has no product in it at all. It's really the comparative arm. We then asked women to come back monthly, and every month they got HIV testing, they got comprehensive counseling, they received condoms, they received contraception, they underwent a pregnancy test, they were evaluated for any symptoms that might make us want to do a pelvic exam or test for sexually transmitted infections, and they also got their study product every month, so they got a one-month supply. And sometimes we gave them a little more if we knew they were going out of town or had other barriers to getting back in the month. And the main things we were interested in, obviously, was whether these products reduced the rate of HIV infection and whether they were safe. Next slide, please. So who were the 5,029 women that we enrolled? Most of the women were from South Africa, so 4,000, a little over 4,000, were from three cities in South Africa, Durban, Johannesburg, and Klerksdorp. And then next was Zimbabwe, where we enrolled women in the general region of Harare, 630. And then in Uganda, we enrolled just over 322 women. Next slide, please. I do want to point out that women were different in terms of some key features by country, and this is going to come up when we talk about the results, I think. They were generally between 18 to 40 years old. Most of the women were in their 20s, actually slightly over half were under 25. But you can see that they were older generally in Uganda and Zim. The average age in those countries was about 28, younger in South Africa, and that's reflected in the percentage younger than 25, which is that second line there. And percent who were married was very different, 94% in Zim, 50% in Uganda, and only 8% in South Africa. And education was also quite different. In Zim, 60% of the women had gone to secondary school or higher, and that was 3% in Uganda and about 54% in South Africa. So keep those in mind as we look at the results. Next slide, please. So the key findings from VOICE, I think you've probably heard this, but we did not find that any of these products were effective in preventing HIV, and most participants did not use the products daily as recommended, and I'll show you what those numbers look like, not in great detail, but just to give you a sense. Not only did most participants not use it, the women who were less likely to use the products were more likely to get HIV, and so the women who really used the products were older married women, and you'll notice that there were some country differences there, but they were older married women. In fact, the incidence of HIV or the new infections that our participants experienced were much more common than we expected, a very sobering and disturbing result that I think is one of the top three messages that we are really concerned with. And in fact, at some of the South African sites, particularly in Durban, the incidence was 10%, which means that out of every 100 women in the study, in 1 year, 10 got HIV, which was way higher than we had anticipated. Next slide, please. So obviously we were very disappointed, but the results were very clear. As I'll show you in a second, the study was very well done, and I think the results are very solid. I think the women told us very clearly that daily use of these products was really not the right approach for most of the women in VOICE, particularly young, unmarried women, and obviously speaks to the need for us to think harder and really understand better what products women at risk will actually use. Next slide. I think I've only got a couple more slides. And just to give you a sense of this issue of how we know that women didn't use the product, because I think that's really obviously has major implications, and we want to be sure that people understand how we know this. Remember, I told you we enrolled slightly over 5,000 women. We tested blood samples from almost 20% of the women, not all of them, but a lot, 773, and that included all of the women who acquired HIV. The way that we test for drug in the blood is very, very good. In other words, if you used a single dose of the vaginal gel or you took a single dose of a pill, the blood sample would reflect detection of the drug very quickly, probably within an hour, and it would hang around, actually, for a couple days. So if anything, the blood test would really favor you and give the benefit of the doubt. Unfortunately, most of the samples that we looked at did not have drug. Less than one out of three women had drug found in their blood. So it really, again, comes to that estimate that we said about 30% of women probably had drug at any time in their blood. And that's very similar to what Lutz van Dam found in the FemPrep study, which was also done in Southern Africa. Next slide, please. And then I think this is my last data slide. I realize it's got a lot of numbers on it, but I think it's important that you know what we actually saw in terms of the numbers of women who got HIV. I already mentioned that at some South African sites, the incidence was 10%. But if you look at the numbers as a whole here, you can see that if you were a young woman in our study in South Africa, under 25, at any site, across the board, your likelihood of getting HIV was 8.7%. So remember, again, that means of 100 women in the study, over the course of a year in South Africa, 9 would have gotten HIV. So really very staggering numbers. There's very few places that I think you'll see that type of incidence. Even in Uganda and Zimbabwe, and they're combined because they're so similar, the incidence in young women was not exactly comforting. It was almost 3%. And if you go down to the bottom line, you can see that if you were unmarried in Uganda and Zimbabwe, it was almost 3%. So really very high. And then unmarried women in South Africa, almost 8%. The last number I'll point out to you is that if you were a South African woman in our study who was older than 25, that was not exactly helpful either. The incidence was almost 5%. I'll give you some idea of how surprising or unexpected these numbers were. When we planned the study, we anticipated that we would see an incidence slightly under 4% overall. And instead, the overall incidence was actually almost 6, so really very different. Next slide, please, and I think this is coming up on the last. So just to point out, one way that you really know the results are believable is to be sure that when you do these studies, that you get almost everybody back who enrolled, because if you don't, you may get selective retention, or you'll follow up selectively on women who are more likely to be quote-unquote good adherers, good retention, good participation. You really want everybody, otherwise you can't make any judgment about your results. Very importantly, and we'll see, I definitely want to talk about this, we got 91% of the women back to complete their study procedures. And in fact, we estimate that 95% of the visits that women should have come to were actually completed. So clearly, women liked the study. They wanted to come back. They wanted to be part of the study. They just did not want to take the products. Next slide. I'll just say that there were no safety concerns on any of these products, but we have to understand that in the context of not great use, obviously. So you wouldn't expect to see a lot of safety concerns if women didn't really use the product consistently. And then I think the final slide, sorry I keep saying that, I just want to point out that obviously the only way we can know what happened is to talk to the women who participated, and that is something we are eagerly pursuing. We had several sub-studies in VOICE already planned even before these results were known. I'll point out two there, Voice C and D. Voice C is a study that is led in part by Jonathan Stadler in Johannesburg that has been evaluating community factors and beliefs that can influence adherence, discussing in focus groups and interviews with community partners and others what sorts of things might influence adherence. And some of the things that Jonathan and his team have noted have been stigma, social pressures, risk perception. And then Voice D is something that we began when we realized that the tenofovir arm last fall was actually going to be stopped because of the lack of efficacy. And we're actually interviewing voice participants about their attitudes about the study, about HIV risk, and their impact on adherence. And we're going to be pursuing probably more intense interviews with participants as is possible over the coming months, because I think that's critical. I don't know if there are any more slides, but just my conclusion slide. So just to emphasize the main messages, really, I think I've already said the incidence was substantially higher than we expected. No drug significantly reduced the risk of HIV. Adherence was low, particularly among younger and married women who were most at risk. And these results are very consistent with FemPrep. And I think that, if anything, this has galvanized us to recognize that it's not just about the product. I think we knew that, but this has really crystallized that attitude, and that we have to understand HIV risk perception and the other determinants of adherence. And I think one thing that I have been learning more than ever is that I really don't believe there's anything that's a purely biomedical intervention. These are biobehavioral interventions, and if we don't understand where participants are coming from as they struggle to stay healthy in their lives, then we're not going to make any headway. So I think I'll finish there. I do believe I have one more slide. Yeah, I just wanted to put a slide up and really acknowledge the incredible team that we had. They're listed here. The study drugs were provided by Gilead and Conrad, and the study was funded by the National Institutes of Health. And those are the site teams and the SHARP team and our FHI 360 team. And I'll stop there.
Great. Jeannie, thank you so much. And we've added a slide here, which was unknown to you, that just lets people know that there are a number of ways to ask questions. You can unmute your line by dialing *7, and then we would ask that you put it back on mute later with *6. If you're on the web interface, you can enter questions in the chat box, or you can email questions at avac@avac.org. I know there were many, many questions, and also on the AVAC website, you'll find a link to a conversation that had been running over the last several days from the IRMA listserv, the Rectal Microbicide Advocates listserv, that Jim Pickett provided us to see the wealth of conversation. What I know there are many questions. What I think we might want to do is focus, at least for the next little while, on questions related to the data itself that Jeannie just presented from the trial. There are obviously a lot of questions and conversations that we do want to have about the implications of the results, but I think we'll start with the conversation specific to the results, and then we'll go forward. There are a number of questions that have been provided already from people on the line, and there were a couple about trial the data that you just presented, Jeannie. So let me start with one. This issue about what we know about the products and the safety of these products, and this issue of what is seen to be very low adherence, and the question came up: was the data about adherence at all known to the DSMB when two of the three arms were stopped early due to futility back in 2011? If they were aware of low adherence when they described the products as safe but not effective then?
That's a great question, and it brings up something I did not have time to point out. So when we conducted Voice, we knew adherence was going to be an issue because it's been an issue in every PrEP study, right? In IPREX, as you recall, 50% of men were adherent, so we're really not hugely lower than IPREX, actually. We're, as I mentioned, about 30%. So how did we monitor adherence? We did it in two ways as the study went on, actually three ways. First of all, we asked women to bring back their unused products and their empty pill bottles. So for the women who were taking pills, we asked them to bring back any pills they didn't take, and if they finished their pills, we asked them to bring back their empty bottles. For the women in the gel arms, we asked them to bring back their unused applicators full of gel. When we looked at those measures of adherence, actually the estimates of adherence were between 85 and 90%. So very good and very, very different than what we found with the drug levels, which is, I think, well worth discussing. The other two ways we evaluated adherence were face-to-face interviews, because we wanted to help identify barriers to adherence and talk to participants about that. In fact, we had adherence counselors who, midway through the study, underwent a training to enhance their ability to really get participants to open up about barriers to adherence. And then the third way we did it was to do something called a CASI, or audio computer assisted self-interview, which takes the human interviewer out of the equation and just asks women to listen to an interview on a computer and estimate how many doses they took in the last week. By all those measures, the adherence rates were good, so above 85%, and that's what the DSMB saw. So the DSMB really had no reason to question whether or not the adherence was really responsible for the lack of efficacy seen. We didn't measure drug until the end of the study. Now, a lot of people, and I don't know if you want me to get into this, Mitchell, but I know it certainly came up on the IRMA discussion, said, well, why didn't you measure drug during the study? If you knew this, wouldn't you have done something different? And in fact, participants, who are very savvy, of course, during the disclosure discussion said, well, why didn't you measure drug, and that way you could have gotten rid of the women from the study who weren't adhering? Well, I think that these results are really going to transform the field of adherence monitoring, because clearly if we had known this a year into the study, six months into the study, we would have probably done something differently. You know, it's tough because you have to maintain blinding in a study like this, but you really want to think carefully about how you can use these tools going forward if you design studies differently. So great question.
Great. Thanks so much, Jeanie. Another question, and not surprising, a lot of them clustering around adherence issues, but another one that comes actually from Anna Forbes in a conversation that a lot of people had at the conference last week. There is a payment required in South Africa through the Medicines Control Council for compensating trial participants, and she's asking, how does the level of 150 rands in South Africa compare at all to what is required in Uganda and Zimbabwe, and might that have affected people's interest in being in the trial?
Yeah, great question. So all, as you know, as you note, Anna and Mitchell, that is a Medicines Control MCC Council, requirement. So that is absolutely something that we are required to do in South Africa. In Uganda and Zimbabwe, there is no such requirement. So generally, women were not compensated with money. However, it's important to recognize that the compensation at all sites went well beyond cash, because as I mentioned, women got pap smears, they got HIV screening, pregnancy testing, contraception, etc. So I think the package in general was quite generous and compelling. I think that we have to take a look very carefully when we go back and talk to participants and ask them, what was it that you really liked about being in the study that made you come back 95% of the time? Was it the fact that you did get this extra incentive, and we'll be able to look at that in South Africa versus the other sites? Was it the fact that you had a community of people, really, who were organized and dedicated to your well-being? I think that, you know, what one thing I've taken away from this is that, you know, women and everybody, really, including us, really need care. They need a place that they can be listened to, they can get good information, and they can get prevention. For the women in Voice, that HIV pill prevention or HIV gel prevention just didn't really fit into that framework for them very well. But it doesn't mean that, you know, they didn't really need and appreciate this type of infrastructure. And maybe that's the message that we need to take away, that we can't really plan to, you know, intervene and provide these single pathogen, single virus, single bacteria interventions. We really need to look at people holistically and think about how their needs and our desires to help fit into their lives. And I think that's a really, really big challenge going forward. But thanks for that question, Anna.
Great. Thanks, Jeannie. Another one, and I'm going to open the line. I see someone has their hand up. I can see it through the line. But a question first related to this as well. How much work is done prior to actually enrolling women in the study about adherence and addressing kind of the broader health literacy issues? So what goes on in that process before they actually become a trial participant?
Great. So in terms of trial literacy, let me start with that. We have had, I think, one of the most engaged, incredible community working groups and educators at all of these sites. We have done special retreats with our community working group to help them understand and then translate to their constituents what a clinical trial is. Why do you need to have a placebo? You know, what is this thing called efficacy, and what is this thing called a risk estimate, and how do you understand that? We've done at least 3 retreats with the CWG to really help them understand this, not just for their own empowerment, but to help them really talk to potential participants and participants. And I think that has been really, really important. I've been incredibly excited about that. So I think trial literacy and research literacy is really critical to get participants invested. How might that translate to adherence? I think that's a great question, and we don't know. There were many, many quote-unquote studies of acceptability of PrEP and of microbicides in women before our study launched. I can't tell you how many papers I've reviewed that assessed women's readiness to use a vaginal microbicide. And, of course, they all pointed to a very high level of acceptability. And it included, those studies included women exactly like those in Voice. So, you know, I think it gets back to the point of, do we need to think about formative research that precedes these studies where we actually enroll the real participants first and give them a product or give them a surrogate for a product and say, okay, you're going to use this for a month. We're going to ask you to use this for a month. Let's see how it goes. When you come back, we're going to measure the product and we're going to see what really happened and what the issues were. So I, again, think that this study will change the paradigm for how we think about efficiently recruiting women so that we can get the best and most meaningful result possible.
Great. Thanks, Jeannie. We have a question from a young lady in Washington, Polly Harrison, who actually asked in advance if we could put the slide about the sub-studies back up. Polly, if you want to unmute, you can hit *7.
I think I did.
There you go. Yes, we hear you. Go ahead.
Thank you. My question has to do with side effects, Jeannie. What do we know about what those were and what role they may have played in women's ability or willingness to use?
Yeah, good morning, Polly, and thanks for that question. So as you know, some of the other PrEP studies, particularly PARTNERS and IPREX, which studied the oral products, Truvada and tenofovir, did report that when participants started the products, they had the anticipated side effects, mostly gastrointestinal, of nausea, vomiting, and to a lesser extent, some diarrhea. We monitored those outcomes throughout the study. Obviously, we were blinded, but every month we had our participant safety review team call, and we never saw any patterns that were concerning, nothing that would have been above the expected kind of level of noise that you would see in this young population living where they live. So no indication that there were early symptoms by arm that might have prompted the women to stop. We were especially concerned because, you know, many women actually went on contraceptives at the time of enrolling in the study. I don't have the exact numbers yet. We're looking at that. But, you know, obviously if you're starting an oral contraceptive and an oral antiretroviral, that could be a concern. But I don't think that we are going to show that. Certainly there was no indication that that was a player in the decision to stop using.
Well, I was going to ask the question about the contraceptives, but you've just answered it. Thanks very much, Jeannie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great. We do have a lot of other questions that have come in electronically, but anyone else want to ask in person? You can hit *7 to unmute your line. I would ask that you introduce yourself just so we know. Any questions right now? All right. Well, people are thinking of their questions, and again, *7. A quick one from someone who asked, how often were women actually seen at the clinic, and how often did they receive HIV tests?
That's an easy one, so I won't take too long to answer it. It was every month.
Every month, great.
Right, right, and that's really important because you do not, and you need to do that because you do. If somebody gets HIV infection, you don't want them to remain on a single HIV drug.
Absolutely. And related to frequency, someone asked a really interesting perspective on this and said to this participant, it's counterintuitive that application of the product, use of the product once a day would be more difficult than applying it at each time of having sex. Can you speculate why that is?
And it would be speculation. Thank you for using that very important verb. Sometimes as scientists we say hypothesize. Why would it be? I think that going into this, it's always very easy to, in retrospect, say what you would have done. But I can tell you what our thinking about daily use was. There were two main advantages that we saw. First of all, doing vaginal product daily or inserting it daily would allow for the drug to build up in the tissues, in the cells, in the vaginal epithelium, in the tissues around there, so that women would really have a reservoir of active product, so really a substantial, we thought, level of protection. The second thing was that not all sex is planned, and I think that's one of the driving forces behind the question. You just don't know in many cases, particularly when women may not have control over whether they are having sex, when they have sex, let alone whether their partner uses a condom. So we kind of thought the same thing. I guess that, you know, it really comes down to the fact that not all women are the same. Obviously, it sounds really kind of ridiculously simple to say that, but women are going to have different needs depending on how their sexual lives unfold. For some women, using it in the before and after sense is going to work perfectly fine, I think, in terms of logistics. For other women, we really thought that daily use would be not only acceptable, but also effective. So that was our hypothesis as well.
Great. Thanks, Jeannie. Again, *7 to unmute. Any questions from the line? All right. We have lots of them here, but I do want to give time for people on the phone. Okay. A question, actually a number of questions about trying to understand more about some of the participants in the trial. And I know that you covered some of this, Jeannie, in the data, but a question about the variations about age and marital status and the potential influence on adherence, which I know you went through, but I wonder, a couple questions came in about that issue, and wonder if you might want to spend just a minute parsing that out just a little bit.
Yeah, happy to do that. So you may recall that although most of the women were under 25, slightly more than half, we had very good representation for what we consider older women, right, greater than 25, which is a very low cutoff, and also married women. So as I mentioned, most of the women in Zimbabwe were married, whereas most of the women in South Africa were unmarried. When we looked at predictors of detecting blood drug or drug in the blood, it was very clear that the women who were more likely to have blood detected were those who were married, those who were older than 25, and something I didn't mention, those who reported a primary male partner, male sex partner, who was over 28. So when you take a step back and look in the aggregate at those women who were reporting consistent use. Those are probably women whose lives are pretty stable. They are, I'm kind of intuiting this or deducting this, I guess, is a better term, and we'll be looking at this more carefully, particularly as we try to go back and talk to participants. But you could say if a woman is older, she's married, she has an older partner, it's probably different than a 19-year-old, you know, who's not married, who doesn't have a primary partner, who may live in a more sort of transitional setting, or certainly is in a more transitional phase of her life. Those older married women with older partners are very similar to the types of women who enrolled in the Partners in Prevention study, in which you may recall the investigators enrolled both members of a couple and randomized the HIV uninfected person to get oral tenofovir or Truvada. And that study showed almost a 70% to 80% reduction in HIV acquisition with excellent adherence. So I think something for us to think about going forward is not only what was different about the women in that study, but what about that study design and how it was conducted really enabled the women in the study to maintain that very high level of adherence and experience that excellent reduction in HIV acquisition. And that's something that I think is going to be fascinating to look at, and how can we learn from what they did, what happened there, to translate to this younger, very vulnerable group of women.
Great, Jeannie. And actually, a related question about partners, that not with with a lowercase p, and that is, did the voice study involve the male partners at all in outreach directly to generally engage them in the trial and potentially to improve adherence?
Right, great question. So we realized early on that partner involvement was critical. We actually had a formal assessment every 3 months of something that we called social harms, where we specifically and systematically asked participants whether they experienced any harm from being in the study, and that was defined very broadly, whether it was shame, stigma, pressure to not return to the study, pressure to get rid of the study products, etc. And one thing that did come across was that as we were looking at those data, obviously, was that, you know, partners, not surprisingly, particularly in some settings, have a huge impact. We could not approach partners directly, obviously, because we had to honor the participants' confidentiality at all times as a real fundamental principle. But we did, with our community working groups in particular, have several very targeted meetings for male partners, and I've got some great photographs from Zimbabwe where there are dozens of men who have actually come to these meetings to learn about the study. So there was very focused community outreach to let male partners know about the study, to let them know that this was not a study of HIV-infected women, because that was a misperception that participants did report to us, particularly since, you know, they had HIV drugs as part of being in the study, or what looked like HIV drugs anyway. And then in Voice C, we also enrolled men who happened to have partners in the study. So there was more focused outreach to that group.
Great. Thanks so much, Jeannie. An additional question has come in related to what's happened now, at least in the last week, and I wonder if, and I don't know if Mike Trenji, if you're on the line as well, but I'm wondering if you all have any quick sense of what kind of reactions you had as the results have been provided back to the trial participants.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I can give you some things I've heard. I haven't been in Africa, obviously, but is Mike on or anyone from the team who might want to address that?
Mike, if you're on or others from the Voice team, *7 to unmute.
While we're waiting, just in the interest of time, please interrupt me if anybody does come on. I will say that I've been following the process locally by email from afar, and I really wish I could be there actually as a fly on the wall. Some feedback we've gotten has included obviously profound disappointment on the part of participants, and a lot of, I think, angst and really being upset that adherence turned out to be the major issue. Several women have said, well, why didn't you measure the drug as time went on? Like, why didn't you tell us that people were not adhering, and why didn't you get rid of those women in the study who didn't have drug? So I think the reactions are going to be complicated. They're probably going to be different by some of the demographics or participant characteristics that I discussed, and they may even be different by site. So so I think that there's a very rich information to be derived, and some of our community educators and community working group folks are compiling the reactions, so we'd be happy to share them with you going forward, because I think that's going to be critical.
That would be great, because there were a couple of questions asking, you know, although the study is done and now reported out, if there would be additional follow-up with the participants to try to really understand what was going on.
Absolutely. So we are just now, in fact, as soon as I get off this call, I'm going to be on another call with our behavioral scientists, because I think that what we would like to do is to go back to some participants with a knowledge of what their adherence level was as based on the drug measurements and say, look, you know, clearly this didn't work for you. You didn't take the product. Tell us about that. There's no ramifications for talking about it. We have to understand this going forward so that we can really serve women who are at the highest risk. And so we're absolutely committed to doing that. I personally think, you know, we could design all kinds of studies going forward, but the voice participants have the answer. So we need to really take them into account and figure out with them what happened.
Great.
I think, sorry, Mitchell. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that I think that Rhonda White is on the call from FHI 360, and she has led our community working group for the MTN and may want to comment on this issue. Rhonda, are you on?
I am. Can you
hear
me? Oh,
great. Thank you.
Great. Go ahead, Rhonda.
Thank you, Mitchell. I just wanted to comment that the Voice Community Working Group will have a call on this Wednesday morning and have an opportunity to debrief on what their experience has been thus far with disseminating results, primarily in the community, but also a bit to share about what participant reactions have been. So we'll
Great.
Be able
Thank
to
you,
share
Rhonda.
This later. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Other questions? Star 7 again to unmute your line. And there are a lot more that have come in, but I'd love to hear any live in person.
Hello, Mitchell. This is Julie Patterson in Cleveland. Can you hear me?
Oh, hey, Julie. Welcome. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Jeannie a question about pregnancy and the sort of what was going on with women becoming pregnant during the trial and maybe having to disenroll, and perhaps, as there have been in other microbicide trials, if you saw some women who would change their form of contraception who may be interested in having the regular testing and that sort of thing related to trying to get pregnant.
Fantastic question, and I took that slide out because I just did not want to overload you with data. So we looked very carefully at our pregnancy incidence in the study, and it turned out to be 7.8%, so similar to what I described for HIV incidence. You know, about 8 women per 100 got pregnant during the study over the course of the year. Some people think that sounds high. That's actually very good for this type of study in young women who are often intending to get pregnant. Some of the other studies have shown pregnancy rates closer to 11, and we knew we did not want that. So this was in a pretty good target range. We also looked specifically at time reportedly off product because of pregnancy, and obviously we held product when women were pregnant for the reasons that I talked about before. And that was the main reason for at least product hold that we imposed. However, when you look at it across the whole study, it really wasn't a huge amount of time that women were off product. So I think we were pretty satisfied that that was not a likely player for the very low rates of adherence overall. However, you know, we are going to look much more carefully at pregnancy incidence by some of the subgroups of women that I talked about, and we can also look at it by adherence, because it may be that, you know, I mean, if women want to get pregnant, it's great to have this kind of health infrastructure to get STD screening, to get HIV testing, et cetera, to get pregnancy testing. So not saying that that was a driver for these women to enroll, but I think it's an important thing to look at with pregnancy as an outcome, and we'll definitely be looking at those data. We really haven't had a chance yet to dive into that, but it's a great question. I think you also asked about contraceptive switching. Haven't looked in detail at that. We are obviously one of the big sub-analyses that is actually underway and will be led by Lisa Noguchi, who worked very closely with our community working group and also the protocol team. We'll be looking at not just contraceptive pattern over the course of participation, but very hot topic, HIV incidence by type of contraception. As you know, of course, that's a very big issue these days. So thanks for the question.
Great, and I will say for those of you who were not at CROI, the retrovirus conference last week, it is a terrific conference in that everything is webcast and available online. There were a couple of different sessions actually related to the question that Jeannie just raised at the end about contraception and HIV risk, and you can get links from the AVAC website if you search on the CROI page. Some really important conversations. We'll be doing additional post-CROI webinars, one of which will be on that issue as well. So a really important point. There are three questions that are seemingly separate but all relate to what next, which I'd love to get your sense on, Jeannie. Before I do, other questions from people on the line. Star 7 to unmute.
Hi, this is Bob Landy at IPM.
Oh, hey, Bob, go ahead.
I'm just curious, as you're asking the women why they were not adherent, would you also ask them if they might be more adherent to another form of HIV prevention, either injection, tablet, film, or vaginal ring?
Absolutely. Thanks for that question. So I think I skipped over that little sub-bullet in my slide again in the interest of time. I think that we are hopeful that methods that get around this issue of daily participant activity, whether it's taking a pill or using a gel, will address the issue of, you know, adherence fatigue. I think that's really, really what we're talking about here as one possibility. As you may know, there is a study already underway that's looking at the dapivirine ring. Actually, two studies. There's an IPM study, and then there's the MTN-020 Aspire study, which is randomizing women to receive a placebo vaginal ring, similar to what women use as a contraceptive ring, like the NuvaRing, or a ring that will release dapivirine, which is a different class of HIV drug from tenofovir, over the course of a month. So women do not need to take that ring out. There were also some very interesting presentations at CROI where different injectables are being studied and at various stages of study, and these injectables would function pretty much like depo progesterone. Really, they would, you know, release an anti-HIV drug over the course of weeks to months. I think those products hold great promise. I think we have to be careful, though, and continue to question and take a step back and say, what is it that really was the barrier here? Is it women's not wanting to use something daily, or is it women's not thinking that they just didn't need anything, period? Because if they don't think they need anything, period, to prevent HIV, they may not be, you know, amenable to these other long-acting methods. So I'm very excited and encouraged about these products, but I don't think we can lose sight of the fact that we still need to understand at a formative level what women want and what they will use. And that's really, really, really critical, because we can't just keep thinking these solutions that we come up with are going to be the holy grail. I'm not saying that in a pejorative way, but I think that active involvement of people who are going to use the product in a way that probably reflects a shift in how these things are designed and studied is really going to be important.
Great. Thanks, Jeannie. And interestingly enough, one of the questions about kind of what next related to the injectable, and for those, again, who weren't at CROI, in the session where Jeannie presented these results at the conference last week, just before her, one of the presentations related to early research in animals, looking at one of the long-acting injectables, and someone asked a question about that, and it left a question and more a comment that even though adherence won't be the issue in the same way with an injection you get every 3 months, ensuring retention in the trial to come back is going to be critical. That loss to follow-up to the trial itself may be harder and have the same kind of adherence challenge that one has with product use. So a really important point there.
And I would just add to that, Michelle, I think that's a great point, but the other thing that we really have to think about in a different way with the long-acting products is safety, right? I mean, with these products, when you have a daily pill or a daily gel, you know, clearly there can be safety issues, but if you stop it, it's going to resolve pretty quickly. I mean, the issue with the long-acting stuff is that we have to be extra vigilant about, you know, the fact that we are going to have these drugs in our bodies for quite a lot longer, and we're going to have to be sure that that's okay.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I have to say, from an advocacy perspective, one of the things, if you look back over the last decade or so of prevention research results, the products that don't yet have efficacy results tend to be the best products. I guess a word of caution to all of us coming out of the reports last week is that the next set of products have certainly promised, but they won't necessarily address all of our challenges and issues. To be very careful, certainly something I think most of us have learned the hard way, never falling in love with your product.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Related to that, as I said, there were a cluster of questions. One was actually about long-acting, which you've addressed. And then two other questions have come in. One, and I don't know if anyone from the FACS team is on, Schneid, Helen, Glenda, Deborah, someone, a question came in about implications for FACS, and I can give more information about what FACS is, but I would rather have one of you do it if you're on the line. Anyone from the FACS team, and if there'll be any impact from these results on the FACS trial? *7 to unmute. Well, for those who, I think I hear someone. All right. Well, for those who don't know, FACS 001, and FACS is a consortium, the follow-on African Consortium for Tenofovir Studies, that developed shortly after the CAPRISA 004 results were presented back in 2010 in Vienna. It's a trial looking at tenofovir gel, the same product tested in the VOICE study daily and in the CAPRISA study using the BAT24 before and after sexual intercourse regimen. It's now enrolling in 9 sites around South Africa. Unfortunately, no one seems to be on from the team because they're busy right now recruiting and I believe actively recruiting and certainly being very attentive to the VOICE result, but recognizing that the regimen is that they're studying is consistent with the CAPRISA trial product or trial regimen where efficacy was seen. But I'll give one more chance for anyone on that line from the FACS team. And obviously something I think for all of us to be attentive to is how this gets communicated generally and particularly in South Africa where, although the product didn't work in VOICE, it is being tested in FACS and there's clear scientific rationale to try to answer the question, can it work and for whom? Related then, Jeannie, the other question about what next, and the media is always interesting in responding to trial results and how they get described, and I'm curious. I actually came in from a question here from someone on the line about the way in which that coverage is happening and what its implications might be, not so much for FACS as an efficacy study, but for some of the conversations about demonstration projects and trying to understand for whom PrEP, daily PrEP, might actually work. While some of the press might have said, you know, PrEP fails for women in Africa. What's your sense as an investigator and in terms of what are the next set of steps perhaps in Africa particularly?
Yes, fantastic question. So I would look at it separately for oral products versus the gel. I think you outlined very nicely the next step for tenofovir gel, which is really going to be dependent on the FACT study, and I will see what happens with that. I should also mention that tenofovir is also being incorporated into a vaginal ring, which I think is another, you know, option going forward that we might be thinking about. So that's that. For the oral products, I think it's somewhat more, not more complicated, but equally complex, because I think that the biological evidence for tenofovir and Truvada working as pills is very good. I think we have less of a database for women because we've simply had more men enroll in these studies. But I think that if you were fully adherent, you would experience some protection, significant protection from these drugs based on the data. So the question then becomes, how do you balance what we know is biological efficacy as demonstrated in those studies with what women said in the VOICE trial, which was that they weren't ready to use it when they were really at risk? Personally, I think that demonstration projects that involve combination prevention are going to have to include consideration of and inclusion of oral PrEP as an option. You, I think, have to realize that women who are really recruited for and willing to enroll in demonstration projects, depending on the project, are probably going to be perhaps different than women who enroll in VOICE. In some ways, they may be similar, but I don't think we can withhold this effective intervention as part of a combination prevention package when we know it works. It's going to be just really important to study it in those projects, again, knowing what happened in VOICE going forward to figure out why women might or might not use it. So I think it's really critical not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is one thing that I have heard. I will have to say I was pretty happy with the press coverage. We worked really hard to try to get the messages out that this was really the participant's choice, that it didn't work for them, that they were really they liked the study, they wanted to be in the study. And I think overall we managed to avoid a lot of blame issues. So I think we did pretty well, and the press actually got it right for the most part.
Thanks so much, Jeannie. You know, let me ask one other question. It came up a lot in some of the discussions last week at the conference and certainly in the really terrific conversation on the IRMA listserv. You know, we've struggled for years trying to talk about the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. And, of course, these trials do a little bit of both. And, again, you know, thinking about the future, is there a way one could imagine, from an investigator's point of view, thinking about disentangling those two, is there a way to study for actual efficacy and then try to figure out if we can help people use it once we know,
yeah,
as opposed to getting in this kind of netherworld that is so challenging?
Absolutely. It's a great question. So one way to study efficacy is to really be sure that the product is present when it's supposed to be. So you could envision enrolling people who are at risk for HIV and putting them on the product or a placebo, depending on how you decide to design the study, or asking them to use those, and then measuring drug levels to ensure that they were as adherent as you need them to be to get an answer about whether the products work. So maybe that involves monthly drug monitoring. Maybe it involves quarterly real-time drug monitoring. And then you would basically think about not continuing the people in the study who simply didn't adhere. I mean, that's kind of an adaptive design that people have been discussing. That way, you end up with an admittedly select but fully adherent kind of biological assessment of people who are taking the drug. And that I think is kind of a compromise between the real world and, you know, having people be in a research lab for the duration of the study, which obviously would not work in any way. And then once you know that, you really can say, okay, when the drug was present, this is what happened. Now, there are all kinds of things that, you know, there are all kinds of qualifications with a design like that, because clearly the people who stay in the study and take the drugs are not going to be representative of the population at risk, you know, at large. And that's where the effectiveness part comes in. In the real world, can people take it? Will they take it? Will they take it when they need it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that some compromise has to be made there where you can bridge what we know from the animal models, which say that these drugs are like 100% effective, the situation in people who really take the drug regularly, which is kind of like the partners PrEP results, and then, you know, the global situation in a community where you try to get people to take the drug at the real world level, and that would be voice. So some progression from one level to another, I think, is what we need to think about more critically and more carefully.
Great response, Jeannie. Thank you. I know we're at the top of the hour and some people are needing to drop off, but I see we still have a very robust number of people on the line. Other questions as we come to an end? *7 to unmute your line. Any questions?
I have a question. It's Miguel from South Africa.
Great. Go ahead.
Yeah. My question is for what's next. As you are talking about considering further studies to the follow-up of the adherence and all the other problems experienced, firstly, I think that my comment is that my assumption is that the lack of adherence has got little to do with whether the human accepts the product or not. For me, my understanding of Africa is that our problems are more social than it's a problem of understanding things more than anything else at a deeper level. And the question I have, having participated at HIV treatment trials, I've always sensed a need for a facilitated sort of counseling, group counseling, where we discuss our experience in the study. And I want to know that for furthering these clinical trials, it's possible that the people who are doing these trials can have that as part of the procedure, where the people who are participating on trials, maybe on once a month, they sit collectively and discuss these things, because that is where people start speaking openly about what they are experiencing, what is happening, are they taking the treatment, and they can be open. If they have someone, because we did that stuff from time to time, but it was without facilitation because we would do it sitting there waiting to see a doctor. So is it possible that that can be done as part of the study?
Yeah, thank you. I had a little trouble hearing everything. I think your question or what I got at the end there, and Mitchell, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that there should be opportunities for participants to discuss their participation in an ongoing real-time basis, and that there could be discussions about barriers to adherence, barriers to participation, and other issues. And in fact, I think that's really important. We did have collective participant information sessions. So there was that opportunity in voice that happened at the site level, and so it was more, kind of site-specific. But I think building that sort of thing into a study going forward where you're really trying to address these adherence issues in real time is a fantastic idea, and I think well worth doing. And it's clearly worked. It's worked in the adherence field in the treatment arena, as you mentioned. So thank you for that.
Great. Thanks, Jeannie. Thank Buki for that. I know it's a little past. Any last questions from anyone on the line? *7. Jeannie, any last thoughts from your perspective or any last comments you'd like to make?
I just want to thank everyone for their incredible support of the trial and their ongoing commitment to getting success in this field. I think that the prevention field has been a wild roller coaster ride, and certainly for us it's been a wild ride in voice. So thanks for sticking with us throughout, and I look forward to continuing this dialogue as we try to figure out what happened and move forward with that knowledge. So thank you very much, everybody, for being on the call. And thanks to the voice team for those who are on here.
Great. Thanks, Jeannie. And speaking of the voice team, I just got a call. I think, as many of you may know, in the United States, the clocks changed over the weekend. I think, Mike Trenge, are you on the line now? If you are *7 to unmute. Mike? For those who don't know, Mike Trenge at the University of Zimbabwe and co-principal investigator with Jeannie have really led this remarkable trial, this remarkable odyssey that many of us have been along on the ride, and they've done just a terrific job. And I just want to say at the end, and thank you all for being on the call, and thank you, Jeannie and Mike, for all that you've done. And the whole team, and particularly, the incredible contribution of over 5,000 women in Uganda, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. I think for all of us on the line, advocate, policymaker, funder, researcher, nothing about HIV prevention research has ever been easy. Certainly nothing in the prevention research arena, PrEP and microbicide, has ever been easy. And every one of these trials has taught us so much, and I really sense that the voice result, given its complexity as a trial, looking at both topical and oral PrEP, and the fact that it's coming on the heels of a number of other trials from partners to IPREX to FemPrep to TDF2, tells us increasingly more. And I think the challenge for all of us is what we take away from these results. Not that in this trial, these three different prevention modalities failed to provide additional protection, although that is a fact and we have to deal with that. But the lessons we need to learn about trial design, about the products that we choose to study going forward, and perhaps most importantly, the need for all of us for humility to step back and listen to each other, and particularly listen to those 5,000 women. They're telling us something. We've not always listened. We've not always heard. But the future for prevention research depends on our ability to listen very closely to what they're telling us out of the voice trial and adjust what we do as a community. And we look forward to working with all of you as advocates, as partners, as researchers to continue the pursuit of additional options. There are, I know, other questions that got asked that we didn't have time for. We'll be posting those as they emerge on the web. I know that the IRMA listserv will continue to be a very rich place for the conversation to continue. There will be additional post-CROI calls that we will look to do. There are a number of issues in not only the voice results and what they mean for the future for prevention research, but conversations about long-acting injectables, conversations about contraception and HIV and the development of multi-purpose prevention technologies, and obviously a lot of conversation last week and for the future about cure research and a way forward there. So thank you again for joining, and thank you, Jeannie. I know it's very early in Seattle, but really appreciate your time of walking all of us through these results and helping us all chart the path forward. So thanks all, and stay tuned for more.
Thanks, Mitchell. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.